Welcome to HN Pod, the daily podcast where we break down the top trending stories from Hacker News. I am Mike, and I am joined as always by my co-host, Sarah.
Hey everyone, it is great to be here for episode 394. We have got a really fantastic lineup for you today, covering the biggest stories from yesterday, May 12th, 2026.
We really do. Today we are talking about some major drama in the 3D printing world with Bamboo Lab, a surprise hardware announcement from Google, a massive wave of nostalgia with some old desktop operating system screenshots, a hilarious ad blocker inspired by the movie They Live, and we will wrap up with a masterclass on learning software architecture from the creator of Rust Analyzer.
Let us dive right into that first story, which got over 1,100 points yesterday. The title is Bamboo Lab is Abusing the Open Source Social Contract. This is a blog post by Jeff Gerling, and it really struck a nerve with the hardware and open source communities.
Yeah, Jeff does not hold back here. For some context, Bamboo Lab makes incredibly popular 3D printers. They're known for being the Apple of 3D printing, where everything just works out of the box. But the trade-off is that it's a very closed ecosystem. By default, every file you print goes through Bamboo servers.
Right, and Jeff is one of those power users who hates that. He wants local control. He blocked his printer from the internet, locked it in developer mode, and uses an open source slicer called OrcaSlicer. OrcaSlicer is actually a fork of Bamboo Studio, which itself is a fork of Prusa Slicer, which is a fork of Slice 3er. And importantly, all of this is licensed under the AGPL open source license.
Exactly. So here's where the drama starts. Another developer made a fork of OrcaSlicer called OrcaSlicer-BambooLab, which essentially allowed users to bypass the Bamboo Cloud entirely and use all the printer features locally. Bamboo Lab saw this and completely freaked out. They threatened the developer with legal action, publicly accusing him of an impersonation attack and creating a security risk to their infrastructure.
Which is wild, because the developer was literally using Bamboo Studio's own upstream AGPL license code verbatim. Jeff points out how absurd it is that Bamboo is using their legal might to crush a tiny developer just for making a cloud-free alternative. Bamboo even wrote a blog post blaming this single open source dev for their own infrastructure vulnerabilities, claiming that if this method was widely adopted, thousands of clients could hit their servers and look exactly like official traffic.
Jeff is basically saying maybe your security should rely on more than just a public user agent string. It really highlights the clash between open source culture and corporate control. In the Hacker News comments, there was a lot of discussion about the alternatives. A user named KN100 gave a great breakdown, noting that while Bamboo is the ultimate plug-and-play, Prusa is the complete opposite when it comes to openness.
Yeah, Prusa printers are more expensive, but you get an open platform, and they contribute heavily to open source. Another commenter mentioned their Prusa Core 1 started as an original MK3, and they just keep upgrading it piece by piece. There was actually a really deep thread just talking about how to add thermal insulation to the Prusa Core 1 chamber for printing advanced materials in the winter, which just shows you the kind of tinkering mindset the Prusa community has compared to the Bamboo community.
It is the classic walled garden versus open ecosystem debate. And it sounds like Lewis Rossman even offered to pledge $10,000 to help the open source developer fight Bamboo's legal threats. But as Jeff noted, that only helps if the developer actually wants to put a target on his back, which most hobbyists do not.
Moving from closed ecosystems to, well, another massive ecosystem, our next story is about Google Book. This is a teaser website Google just put up for a new laptop coming in fall 2026, and the tagline is, "Designed for Gemini Intelligence."
The marketing page is incredibly slick, as you would expect. It shows off features like Magic Pointer, where you can select anything on your screen to ask Gemini about it, and Create My Widget, where you just ask the AI to build a custom widget for your desktop. It also heavily promotes seamless integration with Android phones, like casting your phone apps directly to the laptop without installing them.
But the Hacker News reaction was, let us just say, highly skeptical. The top comment by Jay Shush really captured the mood. They said it's just more proof that corporations simply do not know how to market AI. The very first thing Google shows this new machine doing is helping someone shop for clothes using AI. And the comments are argued that nobody is actually doing that, and that marketing has been completely taken over by people marketing to customers they wish they had, rather than real people.
That comment sparked a massive, and I mean massive, classic Hacker News debate. Because right below it, someone chimed in and said, well, actually, I shopped for clothes using AI today. They explained they are very tall and slim, so they used AI to scrape clothing stores for specific niche sizes and vibes.
And then someone replied saying that is the exception that proves the rule, which immediately derailed the entire thread into a deep, pedantic argument about what the phrase, the exception that proves the rule, actually means.
Oh my gosh, yes. People were bringing up Latin phrases like exceptio probat regulum. Someone explained that the phrase is actually for things like a sign saying no parking after 8 p.m., which proves the rule that parking is allowed before 8 p.m. It was hilarious watching a thread about Google's flagship AI laptop devolve into a linguistics class.
It really is peak hacker news. But getting back to the laptop, it is interesting to see Google pushing the intelligence as the new spec angle. Hardware is getting so good that they are struggling to sell us on RAM and processors anymore. They have to sell us on AI features. But as we saw with Microsoft and Dell pulling back on some of their AI claims recently, and Apple being very quiet about Apple Intelligence on their homepage, consumers are definitely feeling AI fatigue.
Speaking of hardware and operating systems, our third story is a wonderful palate cleanser. It is a link to a site called typewritten.org, specifically their gallery of screenshots of old desktop OSs. It got over 600 points, and it is just a beautiful trip down memory lane.
It really is. The gallery covers systems from the 1980s, like VisiCorp VisiOn from 1983, early SunTools desktops, HP Integral PC, Gem Desktop, Acorn Archimedes, and the original NextStep from 1989. Looking at these pixelated, grayscale, and early color interfaces is fascinating.
What I loved about the comments was the reality check from people who actually use these systems. We look back at them with such nostalgia, but a user named Quichquat pointed out that while you might look at these old Unix GUIs and think they are terrible compared to now, actually, at the time, they were terrible too.
Yes, people were sharing their trauma of sitting in front of a Solaris CDE desktop in a basement, complaining about the awful color schemes and sluggish performance. Even an Xterm on a Sun Spark station running OpenLook was apparently painfully slow.
But there was also a really interesting discussion about monitor hardware. Someone pointed out how different NextStep felt from Windows back then, not just because of the software, but because you were looking at a massive, high-resolution monitor with great refresh rates compared to a standard 800 by 600 PC monitor. They called it the 3M computer goal, which stood for 1 megapixel, 1 MIPS of processing power, and 1 megapenny, which meant $10,000.
That is a great metric. The Amiga came up a lot, too. People remembered it looking big and blocky, but someone clarified that the Amiga was designed to look good on the absolute worst, cheapest living room televisions. If you plugged it into a real monitor, the high-resolution black and white modes were actually incredible for the time. It is a great reminder that software design back then was entirely dictated by the physical limitations of the glass screens people were staring at.
Which is a perfect segue to our next story, which is about changing what we see on our screens today. The post is titled, They Live, 1988-inspired ad blocker. It is a GitHub repository by a developer named Dav Mlaw, and it is a fork of uBlock Origin Lite.
This is such a fun project. Instead of just hiding the ads cosmetically like a normal ad blocker, this extension replaces them with white tiles bearing bold black slogans from John Carpenter's classic 1988 sci-fi movie, They Live. So instead of seeing a banner ad for shoes, you see a giant box that says, Obey, or Consume, or Watch TV, or Do Not Question Authority.
I love that movie so much. Roddy Piper putting on the sunglasses and suddenly seeing the alien propaganda hidden in all the billboards is one of the greatest cinematic moments of the 80s. The developer actually wrote a blog post about this idea way back in 2015 and finally got around to building it. It works by patching the CSS injection sites in uBlock Origin Lite to apply a white box mask and randomly tag the element with one of the movie phrases.
The comments were full of people sharing their love for the movie. Someone mentioned that the movie was actually inspired by a short story called 8 o'clock in the Morning by Ray Nelson. There was also a funny tangent because someone linked to a blog post by Jamie Zawinski, or JWZ, about the secret history of the Mozilla logo being inspired by They Live.
Oh, right. And people were complaining that the link was broken. But it turns out JWZ has a referral check on his web server that instantly black holes any traffic coming from Hacker News. He even booby traps the Wayback Machine snapshots. You literally have to copy the link and paste it into a new private tab to read his blog if you are coming from HN. It is a very old-school adversarial webmaster move.
Very old-school. My favorite comment in the thread, though, was from a guy who said back in the late 90s, he set up a web server on his corporate office network that returned fake banner ads for 404 errors. He used the in-house DNS to redirect doubleclick.net to his server.
Yes, he was serving fake ads for things like cocaine-based nasal spray and renting pigs. He said he got some real laughs when people submitted help desk tickets asking why the company was advertising nasal spray. He eventually had to shut it down when a technician printed out MapQuest directions that included one of the off-color ads and left it at a client site. Just incredible 90s IT shenanigans.
It really was the Wild West back then. Okay, let us move on to our final story for today, which got a lot of traction with developers. It is an article titled Learning Software Architecture by Alex Kladoff, who goes by Matt Klad online. He is very well known in the Rust community as the original creator of Rust Analyzer.
This is a fantastic read. Alex wrote it in reply to an email from a physics researcher who was asking how to learn software design skills. Alex's first major point is that software design is best learned by doing. He says formal design courses at university are mostly make-believe, like kindergartners playing firefighters. He learned by being thrown into the fire as a software leader on IntelliJ Rust.
His second big point is about Conway's Law, which says that software repeats the social architecture of the organization producing it. He argues that the difference between messy scientific code and industrial code is not a lack of knowledge, but the incentive structures. If a PhD student needs to publish a paper in 3 months, the code is going to reflect that panic and urgency.
He gave a brilliant example from his own work on Rust Analyzer. He knew the project was simultaneously very deep because it is a compiler and very wide because it needs a ton of specific IDE features. So he designed the social and technical architecture around that. He made sure the core build system was incredibly fast and had no C dependencies to attract brilliant, dedicated compiler engineers.
But for the wide IDE features, he wanted to attract what he calls weekend warriors, people who just want to scratch their own itch in an hour or two. So he split the internals into independent features guarded by a catch-unwind function at runtime. He explicitly lowered the quality bar for feature pull requests to just happy path works and is tested. If the code crashed, it was isolated, invisible to the user, and could not poison the data. I think that is a genius way to manage an open source community.
It really is. You are designing the code to fit the reality of your workforce. The comments on this post were an absolute goldmine of software engineering wisdom. A user named CSM Mastermind posted a cheat sheet of rules of thumb that people absolutely loved.
I saved that list because it is so good. Some of the highlights were, good design is a single idea pervaded throughout. Minimize surprise. Isolate the parts of your system that transform data from the ones that use it, because data models outlive code. And my personal favorite, coupling is the root of most evil.
Another great one from that list was, if your solution starts with, if everyone will just do this, then you do not actually have a solution. That is so true. People will always find a way to use your system in ways you did not intend. Another commenter added that the ultimate goal of software is to solve the immediate problem at hand, but the secondary goal is to solve likely future problems with as little work as possible.
Though someone pushed back on that, sharing a horror story about a product manager who deployed an entire Vercel app that was just a single React component to serve a banner and embedded it via an iframe into their main app, all because they didn't want to figure out how to upload an image to Esquire. They solved their immediate problem, but created a nightmare for everyone else. Friction really is the silent killer in software engineering.
It is a great discussion and highly recommended reading for anyone building complex systems. And that is going to do it for us today on HN Pod.
Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Whether you are insulating your 3D printer chamber, shopping for clothes with Gemini, or replacing your ads with alien propaganda, we hope you have a great day. We will be back tomorrow with more of the top stories from Hacker News.
See you then.